for his wife. Bil ma'roof. The verses in the Holy Quran that repeatedly mention the word al ma'roof. Wa'ashiruhunna bil ma'roof. Wa'atuhunna ujurahunna bil ma'roof. Alladhi alayhinna bil ma'roof. Wa'kiswatuhunna bil ma'roof. أو سرحوهن بالمعروف متاعا بالمعروف. All of these verses and many, many more that talk about how a husband needs to remember with benevolence, with grace. He lives with her. He's married to her. He treats her in the best way possible. بالمعروف. Whether you are with her, you treat her good. Whether something bad happens and it falls apart, la samahallah, you're also going to treat her in the best way possible. Whether you are with her or whether you are not with her, you are never going to wrong her. And that's the best way of how we are able to choose someone to get married to. Let's look at the criteria that Islam says. Not what I think is best for me, but what my religion introduces for me. Let's not be that much influenced with this kind of environment that we have, unfortunately, in today's society. Let's be more focused on seeing the sacredness of marriage. What the Quran says, what Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam have said to us, you know, marriage itself is a talent, it's a skill. We need to preserve it in the best way possible. Two things that create that best form of choosing and the process of selection for a spouse. Number one, how religious are they? And number two, the level of akhlaq that they have. When they are religious, when they have high standards in akhlaq, you're never going to go wrong. Because if it does work out, then you're going to be happy. If it doesn't work out, you're not going to be wronged. And that's exactly what someone had asked the imam. Who do I marry my daughter off to? He said, you'd marry your daughter to a righteous person. Because if he was to stay with her, he will treat her right. If he was to leave her, he will also treat her right. Unfortunately, when marriages do fall apart nowadays, we can see how bitter things get. It becomes an all-out war between two families. And unfortunately, in many cases, someone is being wronged by keeping her in limbo, by doing this, by doing that, etc. and etc.
Ayatollah Javadi Omri, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes.
یه جلدش هی مفاتی الجنان است چه فرون دماغ و سواب داره فرون روزوان
One volume, the present volume, مفاتیح الجنان, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc.
یه جلدش کم داره و اینه که فرون درخکاری اینجا کم سواب داره دعا هم داره سواب هم داره
But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree.
امام اونطوری که اینو گفته بودم گفته دیگه اون امامی که گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری اون ثواب داره
امام has mentioned both of these subjects. The very imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree.
محیط زیست نگه سالم نگه داره این دو ثواب داره
There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment.
وقتی میخوای کشاورزی کنی یه قدر گندم بگیر رو به قبله بیست این دعا رو بخون اینم هم امام گفته دیگه
When growing wheat take some in your hand and say these prayers These are what the very imam has mentioned
تو نظام اسلامی این جلد دوم جاش خالی
We lack this second volume in Islamic world
Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he says, لا غنى بالزوج عن ثلاثة أشياء فيما بينه وبين زوجته. There are three things that a husband should never do without. وهي الموافقة, and that is to be in solidarity, to conform with your wife. الموافقة ليجتلب بها موافقتها ومحبتها وهواها وحسن خلقه معها. For you to treat her in the best أخلاق, حسن الخلق, to treat her in the best way possible. واستعمالها استمالة قلبها بالتهيئة الحسنة. For you to be prepared for her, for you to prepare yourself for her. Take care of yourself. Be clean, be tidy. Do what it is needed for her to also be attracted to you. Ultimately, she is a woman, she's a human being. She has those needs as well. She likes to feel attracted to her husband. Imam al-Kadhim, salamullahi alayhi, he says, Tahyi'atul rajuli lilmar'ati mimma yastazidu fi iffatiha. A husband being ready and preparing himself and having a good appearance and being tidy and neat and everything else that would have that level of attraction from a wife's side is something that would increase also in her chastity and in her modesty. Seeing that we need to adjust our equations and revisit the foundations of what it is that our religion require from us as far as how we deal with our wives. We understand that previously I had mentioned, you know, that Imam Ali alayhi salam used to sweep and use the rooms and clean the garden and clean the place inside the house and outside of the house. This is something that Imam Ali alayhi salam used to do. Walhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children's cries.
There was the Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart, there will always be there, be there.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked and
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Nasser Rafi'i. Please stay tuned.
خود همین موضوع چشم زخم شما ببینید آخر سوره قلم آیه دارد دیگه.
In Ayah 51 of Surah Al-Qalam, we can see the reference to the concept of evil eye. In this ayah, we read, "Indeed, the faithless almost devour you with their eyes when they hear the reminder, and they say, 'He is indeed crazy.'" As you see, we have the concept of devouring with eyes.
مفسرین زیل این آیه نوشتن که تأثیری که در چشم روی افراد هست انکار ناپذیره.
Now, most of the commentators of the Holy Quran believe that this ayah refers to the concept of evil eye and how an eye has the power to destroy or affect someone. This phenomenon can also be seen in other religions or sects too. We have some ascetics who can do great things with their eyes. For instance, they can kill the pain, change an enemy to a friend, and do other extraordinary things. Eye has a special power. Eye can send messages, and one of its effects is devouring someone or something. Thus, the concept of the evil eye is true, and there are many references to this concept in the Holy Quran and traditions. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Nasir Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Gaza and the other Palestinian territories have been simmering with anger over Israel's stepped-up land grab policies in occupied Jerusalem al-Quds, as well as the regime's desecration of the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex, one of the holiest sites in Islam. Days after the regime launched a heavy-handed crackdown on Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque during the holy fasting month of Ramadan, tensions spiraled into a broader conflict between Gaza and Israel. Since last Monday, the Israeli military has been launching large-scale airstrikes against Gaza, razing many homes and civilian infrastructure to the ground. The regime's artillery and tanks have also been targeting the blockaded coastal enclave, killing and injuring scores of people, including women and children. Meanwhile, the Palestinian resistance groups have been responding to Israel's acts of aggression with massive barrages of rockets and missiles. They have also brought drones into the equation. Much to Israel's surprise, rocket launches have largely overwhelmed the regime's anti-missile system, dubbed the Iron Dome, and hit several cities across the occupied territories, leaving several dead
and dozens of others injured.
So, of course, the Zionists have always believed that they have been protected behind what they called an iron dome, that missile defense shield that they believed would defend them from all attacks, either from Palestinian resistance forces or from the wider Arab and Islamic world, such as Syria, Lebanon, and Iran. Now, we have seen, of course, that this iron dome is more like an iron sieve nowadays, because the amount of missiles, hundreds and hundreds of missiles that have gotten through and have landed, some of them in strategic places such as cities near the Gaza Strip or near Ben Gurion Airport in the occupied in Zionist city of Tel Aviv.
Meanwhile, the regime in Tel Aviv has been under criticism worldwide, with many supporters of the Palestinian cause in Muslim countries and elsewhere holding rallies in solidarity with the Palestinians. As the exchange of fire between the Israeli army and the resistance groups continue, the tensions in the occupied West Bank has reached a fever pitch. So far, several incidents have been recorded where mobs of settlers raided and vandalized Palestinian shops or attacked Palestinian Arabs there.
They are so high up in the clouds, let's say, of their own superiority, of their own master race status, let's say, in the region, that they don't really believe in the possibility of resistance in the region really making a dent in the Zionist armor. And what we have seen now is that there is way more than a dent in the armor. The Palestinians have broken through this armor.
While the Israeli attacks on Palestinians have been met with international condemnation, the United States has stopped short of denouncing the regime's crimes. Washington blocked a UN Security Council meeting on the Palestinian situation and prevented the world body from releasing a statement on the issue, saying that such a move would not be helpful to de-escalation talks with the two sides. Washington's support for the regime has sparked an outcry inside the United States, too. Several Democratic members of the U.S. Congress have lashed out at the regime and slammed the United States' unconditional support for it.
We must condition aid to Israel on compliance with international human rights and end the apartheid. We must, with no hesitation, demand that our country recognize the unconditional support of Israel has enabled the erasure of Palestinian life and the denial of the rights of millions of refugees.
As Israel ramps up its attacks on the people of Palestine, such calls for its boycott are growing stronger. But how many more lives should be lost before the voices are heard?
Iran and the remaining signatories to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action are continuing their talks in Vienna to save the nuclear agreement nearly 3 years after Washington's unilateral withdrawal in 2018. The United States is complicating the negotiations by insisting on keeping in place 500 anti-Iran sanctions, including in the 2015 nuclear deal, officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. Informed sources say if kept in place, the sanctions on these 500 individuals and entities will prevent Iran from doing business with the rest of the world, which is in violation of Article 29 of the agreement. This is while Tehran has time and again reiterated that Washington has to take the first step towards reviving the nuclear deal by unconditionally removing all sanctions in a verifiable manner.
It has been the United States who left the JCPOA, who withdrew from the JCPOA. It is the United States who should come first, who should implement its obligations and lift all of its sanctions. And then Iran would verify, and after upon verification, Iran would restart its obligations in the JCPOA.
Tehran has also reiterated its calls that the United States has to remove not some, but all sanctions on the Islamic Republic.
Well, our position is quite clear. All sanctions should be lifted. All sanctions which are mentioned in the JCPOA, and any new sanctions imposed after the adoption day of the JCPOA, including everything during Trump administration. This is our position, it's quite clear, and we are working to come to a conclusion which, you know, meet our demands on the sanctions lifting area.
The comments by Araghchi comes as the JCPOA has been in disarray since May 2018 when former U.S. President Donald Trump abandoned the deal and reimposed the anti-Iran sanctions that the JCPOA had removed. The Trump administration has also placed additional sanctions on Iran under other pretexts not related to Iran's nuclear energy program as part of its maximum pressure campaign. The negotiations in Vienna come as the new U.S. administration has expressed readiness to compensate for Trump's mistake and rejoin the deal. It is, however, showing an overriding willingness to maintain some of the sanctions as a tool of pressure. Many believe that the U.S. refusal to remove anti-Iran sanctions would mean the talks are about to fail or have already failed.
I think that we are in a very important situation right now. We will know in the coming days whether the talks will succeed or in fact fail. And the pressure is currently on Washington, because while the Iranian government stands firmly together in their refusal to renegotiate agreements that have been in the works for years now, the American side is completely disorganized, and it's not sure whether President Biden will remain the majority leader in both houses of Congress for the foreseeable future.
Some also believe that there is a possibility that the U.S. will resort to the old tactic of agreeing to a nuclear deal with all of its benefits on paper, yet intimidate other countries from doing business with Iran using the threat of sanctions like it did during the 2015 nuclear agreement. Iran says it will not allow the negotiations to become attritional. Iran's top negotiator in Vienna and Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi says the Islamic Republic would stop the negotiations if it concludes that the other side lacks seriousness, tries to buy time, or seek to add new topics to those under discussion. Iran says the ball is now in the U.S.'s court to return to the agreement and remove all sanctions on Tehran or pursue the failed policy of its predecessor known as Maximum Pressure Campaign and push ahead with its hostile policy against the Islamic Republic. The Biden administration has so far not taken any solid measure to return to the deal over 100 days after it took the helm in Washington. The next 2 weeks will be decisive, and the negotiations could go either way. More attacks by Israeli forces against Palestinians in the occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds. On Monday, over 300 Palestinians were wounded after Israeli troops fired rubber bullets on them around the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Scores were detained by Israeli forces. The protests erupted after Israeli troops stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in an effort to force out the Palestinians. The violence around the mosque and the Old City were the worst since 2017, fueled by a years-long bid by Israeli settlers to take over Palestinian homes in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. The Israeli regime is also celebrating its 1967 occupation of Jerusalem al-Quds.
There are several facts here. One is that this is a process of, once again, of ethnic cleansing in broad daylight. It is a provocation, obvious provocation against Islam, and has appropriately been denounced by most Arab countries, including a couple of them who are overly anxious to normalize relations with Israel and hopefully will now reconsider what they've done.
Sheikh Ikrima Sabri, the imam and preacher of Al-Aqsa Mosque, has condemned the attack, calling the raid a heinous crime that cannot be tolerated. Leader of the Palestinian National Initiative Party, Mustafa Barghouti, called the Israeli raid on Al-Aqsa Mosque compound a criminal act. Barghouti described the raid as a racist act by an apartheid regime.
Well, Israel is indisputably an apartheid state. It always has been from the outset. From 1948 on, it simply wasn't called that. The apartheid nature of Israel was confirmed in 1967 when it invaded the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem, Mustafa Barghouti is absolutely 100% right when he calls it a criminal act.
The military brigade of the Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, also warned against the presence of Israeli forces in the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The situation is so fluid, and resistance movements fired tens of rockets toward occupied Palestine Monday afternoon. The clashes in Al-Aqsa Mosque have drawn widespread condemnation from the international community. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres urged Israel to cease demolitions and evictions, saying Israeli authorities must exercise maximum restraint. The U.S. government, however, stopped short of condemning the Israeli aggression against Palestinians. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan instead conveyed serious concern to his Israeli counterpart about violent confrontations in Jerusalem al-Quds. Arab nations, including Syria, Iraq, and Qatar, also hit out at Israel over the Jerusalem violence. Some Arab countries, including those that last year normalized relations with Israel, condemned the Israeli aggression. Iran, Pakistan, and many other nations also slammed the attack. In Britain, Germany, Turkey, Jordan, and elsewhere, people took to the streets to condemn the Israeli regime's atrocities and voice solidarity with the Palestinian people. In some countries, like Oman, people gathered in front of the Israeli embassy to condemn the raids.
It's clear, I think, to the peoples of the world, even if it's not necessarily to political classes in the Occident, in the West, that the Israeli regime is a criminal entity, and what they're seeing practiced against the Palestinian people, Palestinian worshippers, which is really a reflection of a process that's gone on for far too long and backed by Western governments, specifically Washington and its allies. So there's no surprise in the fact that people everywhere in the world are outraged.
The Israeli desecration of the Al-Aqsa Mosque is nothing new. Israel has done similar acts in the past many times. Tel Aviv has been violating the rights of Palestinians with impunity since its installment in the region by its Western creators. The regime enjoys full support from the U.S. in particular.
The reason that Israel was created in the first place was that it was meant to be a foothold for British expansion into the region, and to the control of oil and gas, natural gas resources in the region.
What is clear is the fact that the Israeli aggression against Palestinians cannot end through dialogue. Israel has defied calls to stop violating the rights of Palestinians for decades. Many factions in Palestine have also come to the conclusion that Israel can be pushed back only through resistance, and that any effort short of resistance will come to nothing given Washington's all-out support for the Israeli regime at the UN Security Council, the only world body that can issue a binding resolution against the regime.
The people of Palestine have long suffered aggression at the hands of Israel, but that escalated to epic proportions in this Ramadan. The regime launched a crackdown on Palestinian worshippers and restricted their gatherings in the old city of Jerusalem al-Quds during the Muslim holy month. Later in the month, an Israeli court ruled that over a dozen Palestinian families must leave their homes in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in East Jerusalem al-Quds immediately, despite having lived there for generations. The eviction order sparked several protests in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The crackdown that ensued injured hundreds of Palestinians. It also drew condemnations from the international community against Israel, with even the Arab countries that have recently normalized ties with the regime, namely Sudan, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain, denouncing the Israeli forces' storming of the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
it's not only the general oppression of Israel, but Israel got very aggressive with the district of Jerusalem, Sheikh Jarrah, where they want to get rid of all the remaining Palestinian families. The Israelis, I think, did not anticipate what they were stepping into when they chose to evict all of these families at the same time in the month of Ramadan.
The United Nations Human Rights Office urged Israel to cease the eviction order immediately. It said, the transfer of parts of an occupying power's civilian population into the territory that it occupies is prohibited under international humanitarian law and may amount to a war crime. Israel has been trying to downplay the recent clashes, with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu strongly rejecting international pressure not to build settlements in Jerusalem al-Quds.
We also firmly reject the pressures not to build in Jerusalem. To my regret, these pressures have been increasing of late. I say also to the best of our friends, Jerusalem is Israel's capital, and just as every nation builds in its capital and builds up its capital, we also have the right to build in Jerusalem and to build up Jerusalem. That is what we have done, and that is what we will continue to do.
But under international law, all Israeli settlements are deemed illegal. The United Nations Security Council has condemned Israel's settlement building activities in the occupied territories in several resolutions. Jerusalem al-Quds remains at heart of a decades-long conflict, with Palestinians insisting that East al-Quds, illegally occupied by Israel since 1967, must serve as the capital of a Palestinian state. In the meantime, the Al-Aqsa Mosque has had enormous significance throughout the years. In the year 2000, an Israeli official's visit to the holy site provoked a Palestinian uprising known as the Second Intifada. Observers say the recent escalation of violence surrounding the Al-Aqsa Mosque could be a prelude to a third intifada.
As far as I'm concerned, an intifada is always possible in Palestine. The Israelis are putting more and more pressure. They're hoping to keep the pressure at just the right level to cause, to motivate the ethnic cleansing, the expulsion of the Palestinians, the marginalization of the Palestinians, without having it explode completely.
Emboldened by former U.S. President Donald Trump's all-out support, Israel has stepped up its aggression against the Palestinian people. But with Trump gone, for how long can it keep on committing its crimes?
In the limelight. A third of global food production will be at risk by the end of the century if greenhouse gas emissions continue to rise at their current rate, new research has suggested. Many of the world's most important food-growing areas will see temperatures increase and rainfall patterns alter drastically if temperatures rise by about 3.7 degrees Celsius. The forecast increase if greenhouse gas emissions stay high. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's environment correspondent Fiona Harvey. The piece is titled, Third of Global Food Production at Risk from Climate Crisis. Stay with us for more of Fiona Harvey's article. A third of global food production will be at risk by the end of the century if greenhouse gas emissions continue to rise at their current rate, new research has suggested. Many of the world's most important food-growing areas will see temperatures increase and rainfall patterns alter drastically if temperatures rise by about 3.7 degrees Celsius. The forecast increase if greenhouse gas emissions stay high. Researchers at Aalto University in Finland have calculated that about 95% of current crop production takes place in areas they define as safe climatic space, or conditions where temperature, rainfall, and aridity fall within certain bounds. If temperature were to rise by 3.7 degrees Celsius or thereabouts by the century's end, that safe area would shrink drastically, mostly affecting South and Southeastern Asia and Africa's Sudano-Sahelian zone, according to a paper published in the journal One Earth on Friday. However, if greenhouse gas emissions are reduced and the world meets the goals of the Paris Agreement in limiting temperature rises to 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2 degrees C above pre-industrial levels, then only about 5% to 8% of the global food production would be at risk. Matti Kummu, an associate professor of global food and water at Aalto University in Finland and the lead author of the paper, says, "A third of global food production will be at risk. We should be worried, as the climate safe space is quite narrow. But there are measures we can take in reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and we should empower people and societies in the danger zones to reduce the impact and increase their resilience and adaptive capacity. Although rising temperatures could increase food production in some areas that are currently less productive, such as the Nordic regions, that would not be anywhere near enough to offset the loss of important food-producing regions in the south," said Kummu. "There will be winners as well as losers, but the wins will be outweighed by the losses, and there is just not enough space for food production to move. We are already at the limits," he said. "Livestock farming would be affected as well as the risk to crop production," he said, "and many areas were likely to suffer large increases in water scarcity." The researchers examined the impact of climate changes on 27 of the most important food crops and 7 types of livestock. By the end of this century, in a high-emission scenario, there could be as much as 1.5 million square miles or 4 million square kilometers of new desert around the world, the researchers found. Under 1.5 degrees Celsius to 2 degrees Celsius of warming, the boreal forests of Northern America, Russia, and Europe would shrink from their current 7 million square miles to about 6 million square miles by 2100. In a high-emission scenario, only 3 million square miles would remain, according to the researchers. The paper adds to previous research that has found that global heating is already having an impact on agricultural productivity. Earlier research has shown that the climate crisis is already eating into the output of the world's agricultural systems, with productivity much lower than it would have been if humans hadn't rapidly heated the planet, new research has found. Advances in technology, fertilizer use, and global trade have allowed food production to keep pace with a booming global population since the 1960s, albeit with gross inequities that still leave millions of people suffering from malnutrition. But rising temperatures in this time have acted as a handbrake to farming productivity of crops and livestock, according to the new research published in Nature Climate Change. Productivity has actually slumped by 21% since 1961, compared to if the world hadn't been subjected to human-induced heating. with the global population set to rise to more than 9 billion by 2050, the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization, FAO, has estimated that food production will have to increase by about 70%, with annual crop production increasing by almost 1 billion tons and meat production soaring by more than 200 million tons a year by this point. Meanwhile, global temperatures are rising at a rate that scientists warn is extremely dangerous for human civilization. The impact already is larger than I thought it would be, said Ariel Ortiz-Bobia, an economist at Cornell University who led the research. Ariel Ortiz-Bobia says, "It was a big surprise to me. The worry I have is that research and development in agriculture takes decades to translate into higher productivity. The projected temperature increase is so fast, I don't know if we're going to keep pace with that." The research measured productivity by inputs, such as labor, fertilizer, and equipment, and the output in food they produce, using a model to determine how climate change has influenced this relationship. While farming has generally become far more efficient in recent decades, it is increasingly menaced by heat waves and that exhaust farm workers and wither certain crops. Extreme weather events and drought can also affect the output of a farm, particularly smaller farm operations in poorer countries. In 2019, scientists who analyzed the top 10 global crops that provide the majority of our food calories found that climate change is reducing the worldwide production of staple crops such as rice and wheat. Again, less affluent countries are suffering worse from this situation.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. Today we want to talk about one of the contemporary issues that we seeing in the news and the media, the problem of refugees. We have currently about, according to United Nations Refugee Agency, they say there are at least 79.5 million people around the world have been forced to flee their homes. So that's a huge number, because sometimes you have countries, their population is way less than that. There are countries who have, from 5 million their population to 20, 30. Now, this is 79.5. That's equal to sometimes to 2-3 countries put together are forced to flee their homes, either due to war, either due to famine, either due to natural disasters, but mainly due to wars and oppression in their own countries. Among those 79.5 million, there are 26 million refugees, which are being not only forcefully, they have fled their homes, but they had to seek refuge somewhere else. And amongst those, about millions of them are under the age, or according to the statistics, 26 million of them are under the age of 18, which is also a scary, staggering number if you think about it. So you have a majority of those who flee their homes are either women and children who are under the age of 18. So this is a crisis that is facing humanity. Now, the statistics of refugees, it's very upsetting to see that we have countries who, you know, to a certain extent, they're modernized, or they have facilities, or they have the means and tools for people to live a happy life, yet they are fleeing their countries. For example, in Syria, you have 6.6 million people, refugees. In Afghanistan, for example, you have 2.7 refugees. In Myanmar, you have 1 million people, refugees. In Turkey, you have 3.6 million. In Pakistan, you have 1.4 million. And each country would have millions of people fleeing their countries, either out of fear for their lives or either because they are subjected to oppression. So some countries don't have wars, but the oppression that the governments impose on them, it makes them flee their countries. And among these numbers, so you have 34 million are children, according to the statistics that I'm reading from the UN Refugee Agency. And if you look at these numbers, they're just shocking. They're just absolutely shocking to see you have millions and millions of people don't have homes, who live in tents, who live in conditions which are inhumane, unbearable condition, either in deserts or either in cold places where it's not just cold, it's below zero in many degrees. And I've seen pictures of you know, ice cold, freezing, snowing campsites. And you have women and children living in these tents without power, without gas, without water, and without, you know, clothes to keep them warm during these winter nights and winter days. And which is very sad to see that we still are experiencing such a thing in the 20th or 21st century. Now, let's take a break, and inshallah, we will continue this topic.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back to IRIB English Radio, and you are still listening to the program For Humanity. So just before the break, we said we have millions upon millions of people who are forced out of their homes, and they had to flee forcefully because either war or oppression that's been done to them in their countries. What is ironic is that those people in these countries, be it, for example, in the Middle Eastern countries or Asian countries, they flee to the West, to the Western countries. And this Western countries, they open their doors to refugees. Well, they used to, not anymore, or some at least, just to be fair. they open the doors to the refugees and, you know, trying to be humanitarian as possible. But if you open your eyes and look at the bigger picture, you will see that most of these countries who are oppressive, who have oppressive regimes and who are in war, these wars are caused by the same countries, the same Western countries who are taking these refugees and claiming that they are being humanitarian. For example, when you have millions of people fleeing from Syria and Yemen, millions of people are refugees. Who was the cause of the war in their countries? Isn't it America? Isn't it the West? Isn't the West and their allies? Or just the Yemenis decided to kill each other? Obviously they're not, because the West, they are the cause of everything. When you have millions of people, for example, fleeing Iraq or fleeing from Saudi Arabia, only because America is giving protection to the Saudis, for example, they give them protection, they oppress their people, and then people have no choice but to flee. Where you have people, for example, in Afghanistan and Pakistan and other countries, where they are also subjected to the sanctions and to the oppression of the West itself, it forces people to leave. So either the West provides cover for these oppressive regimes to continue, or either they directly get involved in these wars, which forces people to flee, for example, in Iraq or Syria or Yemen or Afghanistan. The West, they had a hand in it, like a first hand in destroying these countries that makes people flee and become refugees in other countries. So when you have millions of people who are fleeing to Turkey, for example, from Syria, Turkey itself, they are involved in many acts where they provide weapons and they provide ISIS fighters. The ISIS fighters, they go through Turkey and Turkey gives them the green light. And then yet you see Turkey saying, well, we are humanitarian, we are doing this and that for them. Well, how about you prevent it from happening in the first place? How about the West and Europe in the first place, they stop their involvement in the Middle East or in poor countries, so this would not happen? Why didn't the West get involved in Myanmar, for example, when millions of Muslims were fleeing their countries and they were prosecuted and being killed, and the West does not care, turning a blind eye to it? So where's the humanitarian, or where's the human rights in this regard? So those who defend human rights and those who think they are being humanitarian, they are usually the cause of those people fleeing their homes and being prosecuted by their own regimes to begin with. So let us not fool ourselves and put dust in our eyes and just blame ourselves or our countries and forget who has caused the problem to begin with. Now, we'll leave it up to here, and inshallah we continue in other episodes. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Salli ya Rabbi ala Tah al-Amin, rahmatin arsaltahu lil alamin.
In the limelight. To understand the roots of the current escalation and the possible threat of all-out war, one must examine the U.S.-backed foundational Israeli regime policy of using strategies of terror and expulsion in an effort to expand its territory by killing and displacing Palestinians, says Noam Chomsky, American linguist, philosopher, and political activist, in an exclusive interview for Truth Out. This interview is published under the heading, Chomsky says, without U.S. aid, Israel wouldn't be killing Palestinians en masse. Stay tuned for more. We'll be right back. I want to start by asking you to put into context the Israeli regime attack against Palestinians at the Al-Aqsa Mosque amid eviction protests. What's new? What's old? And to what extent is this latest round of neocolonial Israeli violence related to Trump's move of the U.S. embassy to Al-Quds?
There are always new twists, but in essentials it is an old story, tracing back a century, taking new forms after Israeli regime's 1967 conquest and a decision 50 years ago by both major political groupings to choose expansion over security and diplomatic settlement, anticipating and receiving crucial U.S. material and diplomatic support all the way. For what became the dominant tendency in the Zionist movement, there has been a fixed long-term goal. Put crudely, the goal is to rid the country of Palestinians and replace them with Jewish settlers, cast as the rightful owners of the land, returning home after millennia of exile. At the outset, the British, then in charge, generally regarded this project as just. Lord Balfour, author of the declaration granting Jews a national home in Palestine, captured Western elite ethical judgment fairly well by declaring that Zionism, be it right or wrong, good or bad, is rooted in age-long tradition, in present needs, in future hopes, of far profounder import than the desires and prejudices of 700,000 Arabs who now inhabit that ancient land. The sentiments are not unfamiliar. Zionist policies since have been opportunistic. When possible, the Israeli regime, and indeed the entire Zionist movement, adopt strategies of terror and expulsion. When circumstances don't allow that, it uses softer means. A century ago, the device was to quietly set up a watchtower and a fence, and soon it will turn into a settlement. Facts on the ground. The counterpart today is the Israeli regime expelling even more Palestinian families from the homes where they have been living for generations. Will a gesture towards legality to salve the conscience of those derided in Israel as beautiful souls? Of course, the mostly absurd legalistic pretenses for expelling Palestinians are 100% racist. There is no thought of granting Palestinian rights to return to homes from which they've been expelled, even rights to build on what's left to them. Israel's 1967 conquest made it possible to extend similar measures to the conquered territories, in this case in gross violation of international laws, as Israeli leaders were informed right away by their highest legal authorities. Meanwhile, the Zionist regime settled and annexed the Golan Heights in violation of the United Nations Security Council orders, as it did in Jerusalem. The Gaza horror story is too complex to recount here. It is one of the worst of contemporary crimes, shrouded in a dense network of deceit and apologetics for atrocities. Donald Trump went beyond his predecessors in providing free rein for Israeli crimes. One major contribution was orchestrating the Abraham Accords, which formalized long-standing tacit agreement between Israel and several Arab dictatorships. That relieved limited Arab restraints on Israeli violence and expansion. The Abraham Accords fulfill another Trump objective, bringing under Washington's umbrella the major resources areas needed to accelerate the race towards environmental cataclysm, the cause to which Donald Trump and associates dedicated themselves with impressive fervor. It is of some interest that the formalization of the alliance of some of the world's most violent, repressive, and reactionary states has been greatly applauded across a broad spectrum of opinion. So far, Joe Biden has taken over these programs. He has rescinded the gratuitous brutality of Trumpism, such as withdrawing the fragile lifeline for Gaza, because, as Donald Trump explained, Palestinians had not been grateful enough